This requires investing in law enforcement that is digitally enabled to be able to be present in these spaces.
Rapid advancements in game-changing technologies are becoming increasingly frequent, yet regulatory frameworks seem to lag at a slower pace. This disconnect often leads to skepticism and mistrust, which in turn can result in global inaction. How can we facilitate a faster tempo for policymakers to adapt to this evolving landscape? In the Global Policy Review podcast, we delve into the intricate relationship between innovation and the regulatory barriers it faces. Our aim is to explore how we can harness innovation to overcome these regulatory hurdles. In this episode, we are joined by Onyeka Makwakwa, a renowned advocate and leader in multi-stakeholder engagement across Africa for the Alliance for Affordable Internet and the driving force behind the Africa Summit on Women and Girls in Technology. Good morning, Onyeka.
Great, thank you, and thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So we're going to start off with some heavy questions, but we do look forward to hearing more about your work in Africa, some of the experiences you've had firsthand. So let's start off by, you know, checking in. How do you see the absence of content moderation rules in the online space having a significant threat to women's safety online and women's rights?
You know, we tend to think that the violence that women experience online only stays online. But unfortunately, it has a real life impact, right? You know, it follows them also offline. But that's because online is simply a reflection of society and not just this different world that is unconnected to our reality. But the greatest effect that the lack of content moderation is having is that it's leading women to be silenced online. And that also contributes to the digital gender gap that already exists, where women are now opting to stay away from engaging online after so much has been invested to close the digital gaps. We actually are failing to manage and ensure safety online so that women can truly enjoy the space there. And I think most significantly is that it also has an effect on the next generation.
Of course.
So many young women now are opting to not even engage in most of these. And this undoes investments in development that go years back and millions of dollars that have been invested in developing girls who are outspoken, who are confident, who are leaders. And now they're seeing that that kind of behavior is threatened when they're online.
I did look it up. I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 billion women are not online. And I imagine that a lot of them are afraid to go online just because of this reason.
Yeah. I mean, for every 3 men that are online, there's only 2 women. And when you think about the fact that in most countries, women are the majority population.
Exactly.
That's quite telling, right? So there's several factors, obviously, that women are not online. One of them being the issues around affordability. But even when they can afford to be online and they have the opportunity in terms of connectivity to engage online, they are selecting not to do so because of the violence that they experience online, but also the form in which this violence is now taking through gendered disinformation is very problematic because it actually builds these narratives of women as not being good enough, women as, you know, bad people who, you know, should not be allowed to be outspoken, to be leaders. And I think that has a much greater impact on society. We see this especially with women who are journalists, for example, who experience so much vitriol online, as well as women who are politicians. You know, we've invested so much on equality. We want women to run for office. We want gender equality in parliaments. Yet when women run and are outspoken and use the same platforms that men use, they are met with these narratives that are designed and built to silence them as well as to discredit them.
Yeah. Now, that's very powerful. And I do see those as the biggest challenges and threats. And also barriers to women, not just in Africa, but across the world, to benefit from the online space and all of the opportunities that come with it in terms of building your own business, speaking up and expressing yourself in any form of artistic way. So, you know, the fear of harassment or some of the disinformation or misinformation content that is out there is the biggest challenge and is a huge threat to women. Do you have any case studies or any examples that come to mind where you've seen the lack of content moderation practices, best practices, or you know, some sort of gatekeeper process that will address these challenges and these threats, the lack of them? Have you seen examples based on your work? And
there's quite a lot of examples, especially on social media platforms, where women are dragged on a daily basis, actually. I mean, you just have to go up on Twitter and on Facebook, I mean, being the two most popular platforms at the moment, right? And in fact, I think, you know, one of the things that I often say is that it's easier for us to talk about those examples that we see on the channels such as Twitter and Facebook. Mm. However, there's also WhatsApp, which is a closed channel, right, where not everyone can see the misinformation that you are posting or the meanness that you are posting towards someone. And news also, misinformation also spreads quickly via WhatsApp without being checked by anyone, without being challenged by anyone, because precisely it's a closed channel as opposed to the more public and open channels. Mm. But we've got a few examples of women who have run for office. One case in particular comes to mind is Uganda, as well as Tanzania. There's a woman actually who's very vocal, who's a member of parliament. Nima is her name, a member of parliament. She is active on Twitter. And all you have to do is just spend a few days on her timeline to see the kind of vitriol that she receives online. But I'm very proud of her because she's actually now created a coalition of members of parliament, both men and women, who are focused on internet governance. So, you know, she's basically turning her experience into something that will actually help us begin to address these issues at a global, international level as well. But, you know, I think good examples are examples about women who have posted an opinion online and just spent a whole entire day of just being trolled. And what we've seen is that usually when you look at the platforms and what they tell the women to do, they say, you know, you can log off, you can block them, you can, and basically it's censor yourself, you know, stay away from it. And yes, you know, while you are in the middle of a crisis, that is a good thing to do at the moment. But how do we come up with solutions that, first of all, do not overburden the victims and push the responsibility back to the operators of these platforms so that they design with safety in mind? And they are immediately there to moderate some of this bad content. In fact, I've had personally several instances where I've reported a post on Facebook and then was told that this post does not violate our community standards.
And I couldn't agree more. I think there's, you know, there's a lot that could be done in terms of content moderation when it comes to understanding, you know, colloquialism or dialects, very specific, very niche dialects. You know, we've had the privilege of sitting next to each other during a panel yesterday. And and I did mention that I have personally lived in nine countries and I speak five languages. And I can attest to the uniqueness of every single, you know, society where I've lived for multiple years. And understanding that nuance and understanding, you know, words that might not be necessarily in a dictionary is really crucial to managing content in a digital and the digital space where so many people are just going online. I couldn't agree more. And again, thank you. Thank you for all your efforts. So what's powerful is at an individual level, you know, it is for us as users mm-hmm. and contributors to the digital space to flag and to proactively seek out those sorts of posts and making sure to point out that they must be removed and they must be removed immediately. But in your opinion, where does government come in and what role should they play within this this challenge?
I think government has actually been missing a lot in this conversation around content moderation. Where government could really play a role is one, ensuring that our rights offline are also preserved and can be enjoyed online. You know, we need to harmonize these offline v digital rights so that our online experience does not strip us of our rights. This requires investing in law enforcement that is digitally enabled to be able to be present in these spaces and make sure that there's enforcement and consequence as well for violating some of these rules. You know, some of the things that happen online are just so blatantly illegal that there should be no need for anyone to even go open a case, but for law enforcement to just come and act the same way they would when they see you speeding down the road way above the speed limit. So I think, one, we just really need to invest in government being present in these spaces and understanding, but also understanding that we need policies that react to where we are. We actually came out with this REACT framework for mainstreaming gender in ICT when we had our first Africa Summit on Women and Girls in Tech in Ghana in 2016. And what the REACT framework actually is about is that, so if you take the word REACT and all the individual letters there, R is that our online experience and policies that shape and mainstream women's participation on in online spaces need to be right-based, right? We should not have to be stripped of our rights just because we're engaging online. You know, so the same rights that we enjoy offline, we should be able to enjoy online. So digital rights are really important. Women's rights online are really important. And we should invest in education. I think everyone needs to be educated with regards to ICTs, but digital skills as well. You know, just now we're telling women, oh, you can control your settings. But we are coming online with different skill level and understanding and the complexity of being able to make a post public or private. So government has to invest in education that moves us towards a digitally literate person. You know, couldn't the same way we have a standard for literacy, we need now a standard for digital literacy. So that's the E on the REACT framework. And then access, investing in access and affordability. Part of the reason why women are not online, which is a big reason, is because of the lack of affordability, not just of connectivity, but also devices. You know, they will buy devices for their children so they can be in school, but they will sacrifice themselves and not be the ones to have the device. So we need to work on making sure that there's access to affordable devices. So REA for affordability, and C is really important for women, and that's for content. We need relevant content, but also we are missing an opportunity to invest on women as content developers
and creators,
right?
Course.
You know, women can develop a lot of content. We, you know, if I look at Africans and most communities of color, we are storytellers by nature, and most of those stories are told by women. They are preserved by women from generation to generation. We actually now have a generation that is growing up documenting themselves, whether it was the generation that was rollerblading and videotaping themselves, or it's the generation that's documenting themselves via TikTok. You know, how, you know, can you imagine how powerful it would be if we invested on women and on the content economy?
Of course.
To make sure that there's relevant content for women to actually, you know, and it's not extractive as well. You know, we need to be willing to pay the women for generating this content as well. And we need to set targets. We have to set targets for closing the digital gender gap. And that target needs to both be around access issues, but also a target around safe online spaces. Mm-hmm. Absolutely critical, because we don't want to send women and girls to an unsafe internet.
I couldn't agree more. And I would definitely like to, you know, dig into the React program a little bit deeper myself. Sounds very fascinating. When was this?
This was in 2016. We had the Africa Summit on Women and Girls in Tech, where we convened women who work at the intersection of technology and policy in Ghana. And we aimed to have minimum 2 women per country participating, and as many more as could afford to make it to Ghana. We reconvened in 2016 as well. So, you know, you can certainly see some of the footage we have on YouTube of the experience.
I'll definitely
look that up. It was so powerful. I mean, in 2018, I think the most common thing I heard from the women was that they work in technology and they had never been in a room with so many other women who work in technology. So we have to break the isolation as well, right? We have to also break the manuals at these tech conferences that we go to, where it's all male panels, maybe one woman, if any at all. So we are hoping to reconvene at some point again. In fact, next month is our anniversary of the summit. So we are not convening, but we are hoping to re-engage online with the network and plan on when we can have our next convening.
Excellent. I might, you know, ask for an invitation there.
We had a great group from Egypt in 2016. That was a big part of our summit because we also invited women who had created, you know, tech solutions. And the group called HarassMap in Egypt. This is a group of women in Egypt who created an online web map to pinpoint on the map where women are harassed as they are walking down the street. You know, the catcalling. So the same way when you are driving, there's like high accident zone, you know, we are warned about things in traffic, right, on the road because of all the data that has been collected. So these women were collecting data on women's experiences at bus stops, at, you know, train stations, and it's called HarassMap. And in fact, because of that meeting, we were able to also create HarassMap for South Africa to begin to pinpoint and have women identify the hotspots for where they are harassed, but take it a step further to also pin where they find help. You know, if you were being harassed while walking down the street, did someone come to your help? Where did you go? So we are beginning to also not just talk about the harassment, but talk about places where women can go for support.
Absolutely love, you know, the interaction between the online space and the offline space.
Yes.
We cannot, you know, tackle safety online without actually addressing some of the societal issues that are happening on the ground.
Absolutely. It's actually a reflection of society,
it's
right?
A reflection, you know, of society.
And very much connected. So we have to tackle it. But also, I think this is really where government becomes important as well, because those same rights and protections that we enjoy offline, government has a responsibility to make sure that they are also preserved in the online spaces as
well. And I think what's really important in this discussion is, particularly in Egypt, for example, women are becoming a much bigger part of the workforce, and they need to go down and they need to go online to actively participate and contribute to the economy. And I think if we manage to build a narrative to government to understand the genuine implication and impact and concern over women's safety, both in the offline and online world, and how that could impact their economy and their plans and their visions, then we can have a proper conversation around content moderation, what, like we spoke yesterday, what could be part of the regulatory toolbox in order to not just raise awareness, ensure that people have the right skills, but the right mechanisms are there for women to sue, potentially, to request the takedown of content, and have a very transparent process that will back them up and make them feel more protected.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things my team at the Global Digital Inclusion Partnership had worked on, and we are working on a new one now, we are currently doing a study on the cost of exclusion to look at the economic impact of excluding women from the digital economy. In fact, when the team that I worked with did this research in 2020, 2020 during COVID, 2020, 2021.
That seems like such a long time ago now.
Yes, right? We found that the economy was losing about $1 trillion by not having women be part of the, you know, be included in with the ICTs. And so now we are actually doing another one to looking at the cost of exclusion cutting across meaningful connectivity specifically. And we'll be doing some household surveys in about 6 countries and some qualitative research, including ethnographic interviews, to really get the face of this exclusion. What does it look like, and what are we missing in the economy by not creating room for women to participate in this digital economy? So I'm really excited and looking forward to, you know, we are actually in data collection phase right now.
Very excited for you.
There is an economic impact because this safety issue online influences whether or not women participate online, and so it increases the digital gender gap in a way that negatively affects our economy.
I'm very glad you mentioned that. One of the questions I had was to ask you if you know of any campaigns or initiatives, some examples that are, you know, targeting policy development and regulatory development in this space to ensure that the right content moderation rules and procedures and policies are in place. And in my day-to-day job, it's always difficult to have a policy discussion or a conversation at all with government without a number, you know, without data, without actually making a point of this. You should probably care about this. Yeah. You should probably prioritize this. You always have to do some research, build the data, build the argument, and go and have a dialogue and sit down and say, right, this is why it should matter to you. And these are the policies that are happening in X market, whether regionally or globally. Yeah. Maybe you should think about this. Maybe you should try and tune in to what's happening elsewhere and try out different tools yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, evidence-based research is really important for informing, you know, policy. So one of the things that we've done in the past is create a curriculum on mainstreaming gender and ICT policy. And we've actually had the fortune of being able to do training for policymakers in West Africa and East Africa and Southern Africa as well. And recently we completed a guidebook for the World Bank Digital Development Team on gender inclusive digital development. So really looking at, these are the people who are managing World Bank's digital investments that are going on in most of these countries. How do we, you know, empower them with information and tools for them to incorporate gender matrix, for example, in their project planning phases, but also as they're implementing and monitoring and evaluating the projects that have been funded by the bank, how do they make sure that gender matrix reporting guidelines are incorporated and part of that? We can't wait until we are done to say, oh, but the women are not here. It has to be intentional. We have to include this on the planning level, and who better else to enforce that than the person who's actually paying for some of this digital development. So absolutely, I think, you know, that's definitely one program that I would like to see grow, where we are continuously providing training for policymakers and sensitizing them around the importance of gender-inclusive policymaking to make sure that they are, you know, thinking about it from the beginning and measuring as well, setting targets in that ACT framework. The last piece was setting targets, that they set the targets and evaluate themselves as well in terms of how they're doing with that, because that's one thing we have not done very well. I mean, look at the SDG goals, look at other goals we've set on equality.
On paper, they're beautiful.
Yes.
But are we putting the right mechanisms in place to track progress and think about what's the next step?
Yes. And to implement, right? Because I think it's quite clear now that we have the great ideas. We might have the great intention as well. But implementation has been quite difficult. So how do we, you know, change? We can't do the same thing that we've been doing in the last 20, 30 years. How do we change our approach to make sure that we are actually going to meet these targets, whether it's for 2030, 2060, or, you know.
So you mentioned the World Bank, and obviously from a you know, funding perspective, that's an important part of the puzzle. But in terms of international cooperation, do you believe it's important in setting the rules and the standards or best practices when it comes to women's rights? And if so, what are the steps that are being taken to achieve this? What international cooperation is already in place to support this?
You know, I'm not sure if we are needing new statements, because I feel like every country has signed on to gender equality. Some of them have put it in their constitution, even. Actually, I come from a country that has gender equality in its constitution. I think what needs to happen now is we need to actually give it life, right? You know, we need to see implementation. There is, interestingly, I'm sure you've heard about the Global Digital Compact that's going on.
Of course.
But parallel to that, there's actually a feminist manifesto for the internet that was started by women from the global majority, you know, hashed out a bit at the last IGF, including at the most recent Commission on the Status of Women at the UN. There is, I think we have these documents that we can definitely support, that have been consulted tremendously. But there needs to also be an investment that we begin to see on actually closing these divides, right? You know, so I know that, for example, there's been more recent announcements through USAID as well as the US government with regards to a Women in the Digital Economy initiative that's being led by the Vice President of the United States. And they made some really strong commitments to the tune of about $60 million from the that initiative, as well as other partners coming together collectively to make about $220 million towards investing in women in the digital economy. And I think that's really important. But I'm hoping that it doesn't just end there, that even in the other initiatives that are funded, that they must ask, where are the women? Because women cannot be a side project.
Of course.
You know, we need to integrate
fully
equality into all the initiatives. So one of the things that I would really like to see is all the funders requiring that everything that they fund reports on gender.
Yeah.
You know, and quite a number of funding organizations, the USAID is already doing that. I believe Gates Foundation is already doing that. Ford Foundation is doing that. But we need to see all the funders really take a position of requiring all their grantees to report on gender matrix, because, you know, women are a part of society and actually the majority population.
So closing onto the loop and going back a little bit to the beginning of this conversation, we're seeing a lot of international cooperation, and we are seeing efforts being done by government. But in terms of the social media platforms and, you know, digital services platforms, how do you recommend they better collaborate with an organization such as yours moving forward to enhance protections online, to actually address content moderation issues and challenges? How do you see that playing forward?
So there's been some effort that started through Generation Equality on the technology, you know, stream of work, to work with platforms around safety. And I think the mentality has to be that they need to design for safety. Safety cannot be an afterthought. You know, so you can't build it, have problems, and then solve them with a commission or a content review committee. That's great, but let's design, you know, the default setting of these platforms needs to be about prioritizing safety. And I think that will make a huge difference, because we've got different skill level in terms of digital skills of people engaging online. So you can't set it up so that the more advanced people are the ones who are able to manipulate their privacy settings better because they are better skilled, they can read English. I mean, we still have that challenge, right? That predominantly the content is in English. So there's definitely a major role and responsibility for platforms to actually take safety into their design and innovation. And we are beginning to see a little bit of that. You know, I mean, I think I mentioned Bumble as a good example of a platform that has really taken the lead in designing for safety. Mm. But, you know, Bumble is also owned and led by a woman, you know, and I think, but I think she's showing us that
you can
it's
do
doable.
It.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's showing us that it's doable. She has prioritized safety in the design of the platform. And I think that the other platforms can also, you know, begin to build for that. And maybe it's an opportunity for them to bring more women into their labs, bring more women into innovation so that they are building and designing also with women in mind and not building for women. You know, in South Africa, in civil society, we have a saying that says nothing for us without us, mm-hmm. meaning that if you are designing and building for us, then have us be a part of that design from the planning phase,
yep.
All the way, and not only when the product is ready for market. And I think that's a big challenge for the platforms.
I couldn't agree more. And I think we all have a role to play in this. I think when it comes to content moderation and when it comes to finding the balance between safety, but also the ability for one to express oneself online mm-hmm. and grow and prosper, I think, you know, roles and responsibilities are distributed among the users, among government, and among the platforms, and we yes. need to make sure that we are all in dialogue, speaking with one another to make sure that we can achieve that goal together and balance both the safety and the freedom of speech of individuals together.
Yep, it's a multi-stakeholder responsibility.
I couldn't agree more. Anika, it's been an absolute delight and a privilege for me to sit next to you today and have this beautiful conversation. I'm incredibly proud of all of the work that you're doing, and I do look forward to engaging myself with you moving forward. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us in today's episode of the Global Policy Review podcast. If you've enjoyed today's session, please don't forget to tune in and subscribe. We're available on all major platforms, and we look forward to seeing you there.